From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. It is always nice to have you along with us. I'm Evan Dawson. Megan Mack will join us momentarily. Let's open the weekend review with a conversation about the Me Too movement, and in particular, the University of Rochester is trying to heal and move past a scandal that landed two of its professors on the cover of Time magazine back in 2017. Professor Celeste Kidd and Jessica Cantlin made allegations against Professor Florian Jaeger, and the controversy rocked the campus with students demanding that their school do a better job of protecting everyone and following through with investigations. We sat down with Sarah Mangelsdorf, the new president of the University of Rochester. She took over in July. I asked her if the scandal made her reconsider taking this job.
I'm not in any way condoning Jaeger's behavior at all. But it is in the realm of the things I have dealt with in my years in higher ed administration. So it didn't seem like, wow, this university has had such a crisis that worse than anything I've ever seen, I don't know how I could possibly go into that place. Instead, I thought that's a place that's in need of healing, mm-hmm. and maybe I could help with that.
I also understand that your position and ours in the media is not parody in dealing with these situations, but there will be times where there are allegations. Until human beings stop existing, there will probably be allegations about inappropriate behavior or allegations of sexual harassment. And one of the things that we've been asked a lot in the media in the last couple of years is, you know, do you finally believe women? I look a lot at the work of Ronan Farrow for The New Yorker, who, of course, was one of the journalists who helped bust open the Harvey Weinstein story, among others, who says, when he's asked that question, he says, no, it's not a situation of just believe women. It's take women's claims seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And take all claims seriously, of course.
Take all claims
seriously. But generally speaking, you know, the vast majority of these allegations come from women who've often been harassed or say they've been harassed by men. And Farrow says, take them seriously. Because the issue is they have not been taken seriously for far too long. And if you take them seriously, follow everywhere it leads without prejudice, no matter where it goes, mm-hmm. even if it takes a lot of work and resources and time, take it seriously, finally. And I think that's good counsel for journalists. What's your view going forward to ensure your faculty and everyone on campus, students as well, that they will be protected and respected in regards to sexual harassment and everything that we would sort of call as part of the Me Too era?
One of the things I would say, Evan, is that I do think University of Rochester did a lot of work last year under the leadership of Interim President Rich Feldman. The whole campus worked on revising their policies, including this policy 106 about sexual harassment. And I think this was really a wake-up call to the university that perhaps their policies were not as strong as they could be or as clearly written as they could be in defining what was appropriate and inappropriate behavior. And the university spent a lot of time on that. There's also a lot of time spent on thinking about improving reporting mechanisms. So if you, a student, faculty, staff, regardless of who you are, you feel you have been a victim of harassment, there, you know where to go, and there's someone to talk to. And we also greatly improved the training that all people have to go through. I think there are different trainings for different groups, and I, as a supervisor, had to go through a certain kind of training. And having gone through sexual harassment and sexual violence prevention training at a number of institutions, I can honestly say this was the best, most realistic training I had ever been through. Some of them, the scenarios seem so, you know, obvious that who could, you know, none of those things would ever happen. But actually, it's some more subtle forms of human interaction, which I think are more difficult to label as that's harassment. And I thought our training did a really good job of that, also did a good job of emphasizing what was the role of faculty members, for example, when students came to them to complain about another faculty member. You know, they couldn't just say, oh, this is in confidence. If a student says they want you to keep it in confidence, you actually can't if someone has come to you and reported harassment or violence. And so I think the university has greatly improved its policies, its procedures. We're trying to make our campus the safest place it can be. In fact, when we participated with other research universities in this country in something called the AAU Sexual Assault, Sexual Harassment it was survey just to sort of get at the incidence rates around our campuses, the incidence rates of different kinds of behaviors, and also who were the victims, undergraduates, graduate students, so forth. And I can honestly say University of Rochester had a lower rate of both sexual harassment and sexual violence than compared to our AAU peers, other major research universities in this country. That's not a particularly, you know, at first we wanted, folks wanted to broadcast something about that. And I said, no, I don't think it's really a good headline to say, hey, our sexual assault rate is only 10% compared to national average of 20. You know, that's not great. But it's similar to what you see outside of college campuses among the same age group as well.
Sure. And so a couple more quick questions on this. And then in our second half hour, we're going to talk economic development, other priorities as the new president of the University of Rochester takes a look at the scene here and looks forward. And we're going to talk about what your vision entails here. In regards to your view, I know I'm kind of hinging a lot on your psychological background and expertise, but I do think it's so interesting and probably valuable in this case. From the 30,000-foot view of the Me Too movement, do you see it as, I can't see it as anything but a net gain right now for society, if an imperfect one. Again, the critics say, well, no, people don't trust each other. Men don't want to work with women on trips. They don't want to travel. They don't want to hire women for projects. There's going to be backlash. There's going to be cost, unintended consequences because of fear. And I'm just curious to know how, from that 30,000 foot level, not even really a University of Rochester question, but generally speaking, how do you see the movement affecting and benefiting or otherwise society?
Oh, I think ultimately it will benefit society. This was a much needed sort of course correction. I mean, I think women, I don't think there are very many women that you could talk to of certainly of my age who in some work environment didn't experience some form of sexual harassment. And I think it's good that we as a society are waking up and saying, no, that's really not appropriate.
Next, a compelling conversation with a local man living with HIV. We had a discussion about stigma surrounding HIV, and that conversation was inspired by a new survey from the pharmaceutical company Merck. It found that more than a quarter of HIV-negative millennials surveyed have avoided hugging, talking to, or being friends with someone living with HIV. Experts in the field say this isn't surprising, that as we move further and further away from the height of the AIDS epidemic, misinformation about HIV has spread. There are misconceptions about what the virus is and how it's transmitted. We invited a number of guests to join us on the program, and one of them was Matteo Ragusa. He's a staff member at Trillium Health, and he lives with HIV. In this clip, you'll hear him discussing the day that he was diagnosed, how he worked through that diagnosis, and now looking back, what he wished he knew in that moment. Here's Matteo.
I'm scared out of my mind. It's been just about 9 years since I was diagnosed. I very glibly refer to the day that I found out that I was positive. It's actually December 30th, and I call that my positiversary. And it's a day to sort of remind myself, you know, that I've made it another year. And I'm fortunate in a way. I know approximately when and how it happened. I have a window of time that I know that it happened in, and I had access to resources that met me and helped me cope with the emotional, like, trauma of that diagnosis. It happened in Rochester. My partner at the time fell ill. And after his hospitalization, we discovered that he had AIDS, not just HIV, but AIDS. And neither of us knew. I mean, he didn't. I obviously did not. And the very next day, I Googled places to get tested here in Rochester. And the only place I could find, New Year's Eve was Planned Parenthood. So, yay, Planned Parenthood. But they tested me. They told me that the rapid test came back positive. I remember the world closing in on me. I don't know if anyone suffers from migraines, but that feeling when you have that aura and the world comes in and you get that tunnel vision, that's sort of what happened to me. Like, I thought I was going to pass out on the spot. Everything seemed so surreal, so bizarre. Like I was living in some sort of Twilight Zone episode. They drew blood for a confirmation test and told me to come back in a week. And I drove home back to my apartment and just sat there for like hours staring at the ceilings and trying to connect the idea of HIV with myself. I've been active in the gay community for 20 some odd years now. I'm a millennial, technically. You know, I'm in that cohort, at the edge of it. I spent a good portion of the 2000s living in San Francisco. I was engaged in AIDS and HIV activism. It was not a foreign part of my life, but the idea that it became an immediate part of my life was a very, very difficult thing to reconcile. Fell into a deep depression. Months went by. Finally, I found ways to sort of pull myself out of it, reconnect with the world. And I think a lot of the people in my life for that, my support system, my family, I ended up seeking care and being treated at Strong in their infectious disease clinic. I'm still seeing the same doctor I saw that first day. Love him. He's the only reason that I'm not seeing Dr. Valenti. Literally the only one. If I'd met Dr. V first, I think it would have been a much easier choice. I think over time it became a lot easier, but certainly I to this day dread the conversation, you know, the talk I would have to have with new partners, new romantic interests, you know, and a huge source of anxiety. How are they going to react? And I've had reactions that have been fantastic and reactions that have left me, you know, in tears.
You mentioned having a good support system, and I'm so happy to hear that. How did you have the conversation with your family or the people in your support system? How did they react when you told them what you were dealing with?
The first person I told was my brother. He's also gay, and he had some awareness, but I think he fell into this cohort. He's most definitely a millennial, and he didn't have a lot of information. He didn't have a lot of information back in 2010. I'm not sure he has all that much more information now, but he was very supportive. You know, it helped me deal with the nuances of the appointments. He became my emergency contact with all the doctors. I wasn't ready to tell my family yet, my parents yet. You know, I remember when I came out in high school, my mother's first reaction, as cliche as it is, was, "Oh my God, you're going to die of AIDS." Hmm. And it seemed like that her prophecy was coming true. I'm not 100% certain on this, and Dr. Valenti is probably definitely more qualified to answer it, but I think I was at the very beginning of the widespread adoption of the one-a-day combination pills. I started on Atripla. And I think I had a detectable viral load for maybe 6 months. I've been undetectable since. And I thank the resources that are available in Rochester for that. It's been absolutely incredible. I brought more people into the fold of those in the know. Eventually, I told my dad. He was the easier of my parents. He's a physician himself. But again, his population doesn't face HIV and AIDS. So he didn't know exactly how to react. I credit him significantly for the education and crash course that he put himself through. I didn't tell my mother for the first couple of years because the rest of my family told me not to. And I regret that. I wish I had told my mom sooner. One, because it was disrespectful to her to assume that she wouldn't be able to deal with it. And secondly, because I needed the support of my mom, you know? Yeah, that's the immediate aftermath of day zero, I suppose.
Thinking back to everything that you've experienced and all the challenges, the triumphs, everything, what would you tell yourself? What do you know now that you would want yourself to know when you were first diagnosed? What would you say to younger Mateo, who's on the couch looking up at the ceiling, struggling? What would you want him to know at this stage in your life?
That this is not going to kill you. This is not going to impact the quality of your life. That HIV is a virus, like a cold is a virus, like the flu is a virus. It's something that happens because we live in social communities. It's no more evil or a punishment than, you know, catching strep from, you know, a toddler or getting mono in high school. It's just a virus. You take your pills, you see your doctor, you'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Next up, do you own any cryptocurrency? In the last month, there's been a wave of headlines announcing the death of Bitcoin. That's because the value of Bitcoin has fallen by 50% since July. We welcomed George Conboy, the chairman of Brighton Securities. You'll hear from him. But first, you'll hear from Gary Palmer, a Bitcoin supporter and the founder of Bitcoin NYS. He says Bitcoin and crypto is not dead yet and is poised to take off in the same way the internet was poised to take off in the 1990s.
If people want to use it, they can use it. You know, Starbucks can be bought today with Bitcoin. It's just the market is scattered and there's not a lot of standardization yet because we're so early.
Remind your listeners, any of them who bought their Starbucks this morning with Bitcoin, please call us. Let's hear from the guy who bought his coffee this morning with
Bitcoin. You're saying not many people are doing that.
I don't know. We're going to find out.
Yeah. I think it's probably not a lot.
They kind of know what it is. It's not really useful for very much. They've heard about it on your show, and it's just outside their daily life. And the idea that having more cryptocurrencies will make it easier to use, easier to become a means of exchange, seems unlikely. The more difficult and complicated you make things sound or you make them act, the less likely they will be easily adopted by the mainstream. Now, I'll go back to the counterexample of Gary's early internet story, because there are a lot of ways to use that example. Gary's got a very plausible story of, hey, we never thought the internet would be this big. The other side of that is, 1998, 1999, everybody knew the internet would be big. They knew it would be huge. The problem was, investors did. And what happened in the late 90s was, you had three investment stories about the internet. Story one was pets.com. You bought it, you thought it was going to be fabulous, and it went bankrupt. Story three is amazon.com. It went down 90% in the bubble, but it came back and made everybody a fortune. Story two is Corning, a company that's been down in southern tier of New York for 1 million years, and they went way up during the tech bubble, and you could have paid $110 a share in early 2000 for Corning. You can buy all the Corning you want today at $28 a share. They didn't become Amazon. They didn't become pets.com. They're still there employing people, making product, but they weren't a particularly good investment. And so when you look at that example, it can be anything you want to make it into. It doesn't necessarily mean we're on the cusp of a new millennium.
Let's turn to a conversation about food waste. If you think it's hard enough to compost and cut food waste at home, consider the challenge for the University of Rochester. They serve thousands of meals every day, and yet the director of food service, Cam Schauf, says the old way of doing things is wrong. Schauf was recently given the Seneca Park Zoo Society's 2019 Environmental Innovation Award. Here's why.
We serve between 14 and 18,000 meals a day. We do 3.3 million meals in a year.
When you build menus around what you can buy locally, that's very different than buying local to fill in the gaps. Tell me what you mean by that.
So 15 years ago, the standard in our business in college and university dining was to build a cycle menu 4 or 5 weeks long, build one in the summertime, and then go out and find the food to fill in that menu. And then you would make a few changes at the break for the spring semester, and again, repeat that process.
Where would the food come from?
Wherever. If you menued tomatoes in February, you went out and found tomatoes to put on the menu in February. And where we are today is we go out looking for the food as locally as possible. We try to stay within New York State, but we're also pushing to get more and more into the greater Rochester area. So when I say within New York State, 60% of the money that we spent last year on food was spent with companies in the state of New York. Our goal this year was to be 20% within 150 miles of our campus, and we're exceeding that. We're hoping that by the end of the year, we're going to be close to 40% with that number.
Within roughly a two-hour drive.
Yes. Yes. And it's very important for us to support these local businesses. But at the same time, we've changed the way that we're doing food. We're looking at the food first. Then we're building menus in order to utilize that food. We're talking to farmers. Right now, we're beginning conversations with farmers as to what is going to be planted, what we're going to buy from them, and making commitments so that they have some financial stability. We know where our food is coming from. They know where their next check is coming from, and everybody wins.
So there are some questions that I think just about everybody would have about this process, starting with the idea that if 60% of your food comes from New York State and may almost a quarter of the foods come in from within about a two-hour drive, does that change during the winter?
Yeah. The 60% is averaged over the entire year.
Yep.
But we're finding more and more ways to continue to buy food locally, and we're pushing. We're not taking for granted that that percentage is always going to drop. We're taking that as a challenge and looking for new partners and new ways to keep those numbers moving. And part of that is also finding partners and helping them grow their business in ways that will allow us to buy from them more in the future. Looking at helping us import certain grains that aren't available to us on a regular basis. In addition, a very important part for us, in addition to buying locally, is also to diversify our menus and to bring in new grains that people may not have been buying locally. Maybe some of our students haven't even tried them before. Trying to do things that support farm cultures and farmer cultures, agriculture in other states and other areas, in other countries.
There's also an assumption that the fact that you're doing this way must add to the total bill for the University of Rochester. Is it more expensive?
So far, no. We are also increasing the amount of foods that we're making from scratch. And so every time we make something from scratch instead of buying it already made, we're saving money. And the money that we save from doing that, we use to get higher quality proteins. And with those higher quality proteins, we're also serving less of them per serving, because that's the way people should be eating.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.